365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212, and in Vancouver at 360-694-1234, or at radiocab.net. This program has also been made possible by Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. Smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Good afternoon, dear listeners. This is Preference. Welcome. I'm your host, Alan, and we have a fabulous show tonight. We're going to hear an interview from KPFA, Pacifica Radio. It'll be two scholars of homo nationalism, Yasmin Nair and Matilda Bernstein Sycamore. This was recorded in June, and it's a discussion on homophobia, racism, Islam, and the Orlando shooting. And that'll take us about to mid-hour. Then we're going to chat live with Matilda Bernstein Sycamore about some issues related to what some scholars call homo nationalism. In particular, we're going to talk about the military's the lifting of their ban on trans people serving, as well as the U.S. Navy's very recent decision to name a warship after Harvey Milk. So stay tuned. Thanks for being here with us on Preference.
Today on Flashpoints, why is the Orlando shooter branded as a Muslim instead of a homophobe? Also, Professor P.J. Prashad talks about the confused declarations of support by the shooter. Which group did he really support? Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, or the Islamic State? Could it be all three? And we'll hear from Sam Husseini, who managed to extract a correction from NPR. A major correction. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Do stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're going to spend most of the show talking about trying to give you a different angle and some deeper information about Orlando and sort of issues surrounding it in our now two-gun society gone crazy. Let me tell you who's joining us for the first half of the show. Yasmin Nair, she is a freelance writer, activist, academic, and commentator based in Chicago. She's the co-founder of the editorial collective Against Equality and a member of Gender Just, a radical queer grassroots organization based in Chicago. She just appeared on The Real news segment, and she's got a piece that you really want to read, get a hold of. You want to understand her work. Also joining us is a favorite of mine, this program, Matilda B. Sycamore Bernstein, although it wasn't up on the sheet. I don't know if you're still a Bernstein, but forgive me if you're not. Matilda is an author, a lecturer. She's a writer, a poet, and she's a truth teller. She's the author of, among other books, The End of San Francisco and Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots. Now, that's an interesting title in the context of today's show. Let me thank both of you, Yasmin and Matilda. Welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, and thank you for having us both on together.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's a rare pleasure.
Really. Well, let's begin with you, Yasmin Nair. The title of your article is Why is the Orlando Shooter Branded as a Muslim Instead of a Homophobe? The reports are, you know, all kinds of troubling reports, important reports, deeper information is coming out. But why don't you start through the title of your own piece?
Well, it's actually the title of the segment that I did on KPFA's Brian Tickett Show and on Real News. But it is something that I'm working on. The big concern for radical queers like Matilda and like me has been this kind of distinction that's made between the framework of terrorism and the framework of homophobia, you know, as if somehow positioning those two in, you know, in different ways, opposing each other, or somehow even thinking that they're distinct, helps reconcile anything. And really, I think what we're interested in doing is to obviously walk away from the terrorist framework, which has been disastrous for decades now, but also the idea of simply thinking about his homophobia individualizes his actions. And, you know, the entire incident now has been wrapped up in this idea of safety, or rather lack thereof, which is to say, as tragic and as awful as it is, and we understand, of course, queers everywhere are struggling right now, grappling with the sense of vulnerability. That's completely understandable, especially during Pride Month. But to think about it only in terms of safety of queer people ignores the fact that, you know, people of color, quote-unquote minorities, queer people of color, migrants, women, people like Sandra Bland, who was driving down the interstate while smoking and was pulled over by a cop and who eventually died in jail, right? A lot of us have always felt unsafe. So when we start to talk about homophobia making queers feel unsafe, we tend to forget that the state constantly makes everyone feel unsafe. So that's the problem to begin with. That's the sort of problem with the positioning of those frameworks of homophobia and terrorism.
Matilda, let me bring you in here. Many reports now about the shooter having been to the club many times, having gone to the club, buying drinks for folks, trying to dance. We don't know if this is true, but more and more information, 5 witnesses. What I'd like to hear from you is your first impressions when you heard about it, and then sort of these revelations that keep coming out. Could you respond to all that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I, like many people, when I first heard about, you know, this horrible massacre in Orlando, is, you know, to be sobbing. I mean, I was sobbing, and over the last several days, just at random moments, you know, suddenly overcome in that particular way. And I think I'm sure that's a very common experience for queers, you know, in the context of this type of murder, right? And I think the problem with all the focus on the shooter is, like Yasmin says, it turns it into this individual crime. And I think, you know, we need to connect it to the mass shootings that our government is enacting every day through worlds around the world, through support of brutal dictatorships, through police terror in this country and mass incarceration. And we need to talk about the ways in which, you know, this type of militarism is fueling violence both abroad and in this country. And I think when people talk about it as this individual shooter, we're neglecting to talk about structural homophobia. We're neglecting to talk about structural racism. You know, we're neglecting to talk about the fact that, you know, the horrible amount of resources that go into the military budget takes away from everything that matters. We're neglected to talk about the actual structural issues that are making people unsafe and causing structural violence in this country and all over the world. And I think, similarly, the other thing that people talk a lot about now is about gun control, and specifically about an assault, you know, weapons ban. And while I'm certainly in favor of an assault weapons ban, I think the important thing to note about gun control is all it means is that law enforcement has control over who gets to do the shooting. And we already know that law enforcement in this country and the U.S. military around the world are doing most of the violence. And so nothing is going to change if we don't actually talk about, you know, the deep structural issues rather than about individuals responsible for violence.
Yasmin, did you want to respond to that? Or?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Matilda is absolutely right about how we're ignoring the long-term effects of the wars abroad. And I think Mateen's life and actions, and this is not at all to take away agency from what he did, but Mateen's life and actions exemplify a very particular nexus of circumstances. And also, in all honesty, a very profound kind of psychosis that is now part of the world that the United States has created.
Talk about that nexus. Talk about that, please.
Sure. The fact is, for instance, that he is of Afghani descent. His parents came here from Afghanistan, I think, about 30 years ago, perhaps even more recently. But his parents are from Afghanistan. He was born and raised in New York City. He had a very particular fetish for the NYPD. He was hired by a security firm that has been indicted, I understand, on charges of the abuse of the juveniles it was charged with protecting, whatever that means to protect. I don't know what it means to protect young people in juvenile detention centers, but it has been charged with causing harm to them. He committed domestic abuse. He apparently was not just homophobic, but had issues with all sorts of minorities. But you know what we see here, and we have. It's easy to say, well, this is a person and his individual problems. But when we think about Mateen's against the backdrop of the fact that, as Matilda pointed out, you know, the United States has been wreaking havoc across the world, particularly in Afghanistan, and you have someone whose consciousness is molded by these sort of seemingly contradictory impulses. One is, of course, to become, in a sense, as American and as American, as American male, right? There's a fetishization of a kind of American mode of masculinity here. At the same time that his father, for instance, and he grew up hearing his father talking about Afghanistan, what has happened to Afghanistan, right? So you have that particular strange kind of nexus of almost sometimes contradictory impulses. And we also have to consider that there's a kind of level of psychosis that is spreading around the world and returning to the U.S. You know, we've seen numerous articles in the recent few months or so about war veterans returning from places like Iraq and Afghanistan, and the kinds of injuries that they have sustained are far more devastating than what we might have seen in years past. And there's also a profound kind of psychological injury. So we now have veterans returning horrified not only at what they see, but at what they did. This is right. Obviously not uncommon. You know, we know this from wars past, that this is not an uncommon issue. But given the depth and the breadth and the violence with which, you know, the surgical intensity with which we're able to wreak havoc now with drones and so on, we have to think about how psychosis returns in a way, right? Yeah. It returns from the wars and it comes back to haunt us, and it creates these moments. And this is not at all to take agency away from it, but it is to sort of understand what is it about a country where we have a man who suffers from all of these issues and is also able to then go around literally collecting, warfare grade weaponry. And
well, let's be clear. The guy worked for apparently the largest security, mm-hmm. private security company in the world, G4S. This is a company that was first charged with essentially continuing the torture at Guantanamo Bay and then selling off their company when essentially they got caught. That's among the different things that his employer was engaged in. Right. Matilda, coming back to this two-gun society and this society that hates its children, you know, and demonstrates that every day by sending them to war, either whether they're sending them to war in schools and hospitals or overseas. And there, we have not, I think it is safe to say, one may assume that this guy was struggling with trying to figure out, and again, I'm not forgiving anything here, but trying to figure out his own sexuality in a country that still hates sexual liberation and restrains it at every turn.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's a real tragedy to see in the aftermath of this horrible act, you know, of brutality, you know, a mass murder of people in a gay bar, a Latino gay bar, to see the way that politicians, you know, in particular straight politicians, are trying to use this to further ramp up U.S. militarism. So we have Hillary Clinton talking about it as an act of Muslim extremism, which is no different or barely distinguishable from Donald Trump's rhetoric. And I think, you know, it's, and you have people like Commissioner Bratton, you know, in New York, one of the worst horrible architects of police brutality in this country, showing up at a rally invited. I mean, he was invited to speak at a rally, you know, allegedly in solidarity with, you know, the people who were murdered. You have Governor Cuomo shortly after passing, you know, these draconian limitations on freedom of speech with his, you know, rhetoric and legislation against, you know, supporting boycott, divestment, and sanctions, you know, for the state of Israel, and also speaking at these rallies. And I think the complicity simultaneously of straight politicians, you know, in their homophobic daily lives and in the legislation they pass, also using the dead bodies of queers in order to further ramp up militarism, right? They love us when we're dead, but they're not interested in taking care of us when we're alive.
Yes. And Yasmin, you want to jump off from there?
Yes, I mean, you know, the issue of homosexuality and whether or not that you raise, whether or not he was himself gay, I think that's what you were alluding to. And as Matilda says, yes, you know, people who are willing to use queer bodies to put forward more drastic U.S. policies. But whether or not he is gay, in a sense, is besides the point. And we also have to consider that there's been a long history of gay people, queer people, being stigmatized and demonized as always, you know, mass murderers just about to happen, or not even mass murderers, really, just sort of, right, you know, those people who are just going to go off the rails at any moment and commit horrible acts. So we have to really have to resist the formation of that narrative. But the other thing is that it doesn't actually matter. What matters is that someone with, I mean, we can be absolutely clear that this is a person who suffered from tremendous instability, which is putting it mildly, and that this kind of person existed in a system, came about in a system that A, has seen a drastic reduction in mental health care systems, and, you know, a lot of people have been saying, well, why were his friends or his wife not more not braver, or whatever the term might be, in telling others about what they feared he was about to do? And my response to that has been, well, in a state of surveillance and worse, where people can be sent off to Guantanamo for the rest of their lives and literally disappeared, what kind of incentive is there for even close family members? Whom can they talk to about what they seem that might be happening in someone's mind? And what resources are there? So you turn him in, and what then happens? He simply disappears into a black hole. So we also have in the United States a withdrawal of resources, not just for immigrants, but for people at large. We have a terrible healthcare system. We have all of these terrible conditions coming about, and we have to, and, you know, so I think the question of whether or not he was gay is sort of immaterial, and in contrast to, this is a person who did this horrible thing, and how did that come about? That is what we have to think about.
And I think also, whether, you know, speculating about, you know, whether he was closeted, you know, what his sexuality was,
right,
also takes away from the actual violence that he enacted. So, you know, 50 people are dead in a gay club, and so certainly this is furthering the trauma that many queers, especially Latino queers who were there that night, especially anyone who was there that night and, you know, may have survived or may have friends that died, the trauma that they're experiencing and the trauma that queers across this country are experiencing now on a daily basis. And that is magnified by the trauma that many queers experience all the time, you know, based on, as Yasmin said, you know, immigration status, or based on, you know, being queers of color, or having disabilities, or being persecuted at home, you know, in schools, at places of work, on the street. And I think I wish that the responses were attempts to actually address, you know, the systemic violence that exists, rather than responses that are geared towards creating more violence.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That last voice was Matilda Sycamore, author, writer, activist. Yasmin Nair is also on the line here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. So I guess the question I want to ask both of you now is, what kind of advisement, what kinds of things, policy things, larger ways of thinking about this, and ways of understanding, so that we can move forward and, if you will, grow from this, which would be good. You want to start, Yasmin? How do you want people to think about this in terms of trying to change it or grow?
Right. You know, every culture and every religion, every way of being recommends a certain period of mourning and certain kinds of rituals. So I think I want to first acknowledge that we're still in that particular stage. I understand where people are in that sense. But I also think that I would like us to start resisting this constant call to reconciliation and love and understanding. And I know that seems very contradictory given the horrific nature of what has happened, but I think love and understanding are things that we should take for granted. But what we now need is a certain kind of pointed anger and critique and understanding of the systemic problems that all of this represents. And I would especially want the LGBTQ community, of which Matilda and I are both a part of, to really start thinking about how the desires and the systems that we have been demanding for the last 30, 40 years have not necessarily directly caused what happened, absolutely not, but they have curtailed our sense of what is really at stake, for not just for queers, but for everyone. So for the last 20 odd years, the LGBTQ community, or rather I should say the LGBT community, or rather even really the LG community, has been fighting for things like gay marriage, the right to fight in wars abroad, and the right to enact hate crime legislation, which, by the way, is also going to come to the forefront much more now with what just happened. But, you know, it's hate crime legislation that does nothing but increase the scope of the present industrial complex by asking for more, for extensions of sentences, for instance. So as LGBTQ people and as straight people and as straight allies, however we define ourselves, we have to start thinking about the consequences of what we put forth in the world and what, in terms of what we think we want. And things like the expansion of the military to include other people, things like hate crime legislation, do nothing but expand the scope of military violence, do nothing but expand the scope of the prison industrial complex. Prisons have never been good for queers. We have been brutalized in them. We have been raped in them. We have literally had our brains cooked in order to reform us. We have never benefited from prisons. And it's atrocious to me that we are now, in the wake of something like this that just happened, we are now demanding, implicitly or explicitly, we're demanding an extension of hate crime legislation. We're demanding that this be called a hate crime. And And I think what I would like us to see is more anger, and also a much more, on the part of straight people as well, straight allies as well, better understanding of what queer radical history has been, what queer history has been, and what else we can achieve outside these very normative goals.
And Matilda.
Yeah, to build on that, I would add that I think, as Yasmin was saying, for the last several decades, the institutions of so-called LGBT power have been telling us over and over again that these three priorities, military inclusion, access to marriage, and hate crimes legislation, will make queers safer, right? And I want to ask any queer listener, do we feel safer now, right? And I think to build on what Yasmin's saying is something like hate crimes legislation as a response only gives the criminal legal system more power, and we already know the structural violence that it's enacting every day. So giving structural violence more power only furthers the violence. And I think I want to add that I think in response to this horrible massacre, I think there's a lot of rhetoric that I think is based on straight acceptance. You know, it's this endless explication of who we are to straight people. And I think that furthers structural homophobia, and structural homophobia is what caused this. And so I think we need to not worry about explaining ourselves to straight people on the terms of the homophobic, transphobic, racist, misogynist, dominant culture, and instead articulating our own values, our own, you know, creating our own communities, creating, not talking about how love is love is love, but actually perhaps critiquing about how there isn't enough love, right? And that love often masks a kind of violence, just like the rhetoric of the dominant institutions of LGBT power, you know, hiding behind a sweatshop produce rainbow flags while gentrifying neighborhoods and removing people of color from places where they lived for decades, and celebrating consumerism without any kind of critique, actually further structural violence. So I think we need to be building alternatives, and also not get caught in these dead-end conversations about something like gun control. If we're talking about gun control, we have to talk first and foremost about controlling the guns of the police and the military. Otherwise, it just ends up being a dead-end conversation that gets nowhere and continues the same violence that's been going on for generations.
Yasmin, want to join in?
I couldn't agree more. I think, it is so deeply ironic of Obama to talk about gun control and also, you know, perhaps even tomorrow start joking about drones. We are not just a country. We're increasingly, given, for instance, how countries in Europe are responding, for instance, to the migrant refugee crisis. We are increasingly a world that is paranoid, places itself under surveillance, and literally puts people fleeing borders in desperation with no food and water, literally puts them under the gun. This is what we have to worry about, and we have to start thinking about how all of that is part of a larger set of symptoms that causes such things to happen, that causes these kinds of eruptions. And again, not to take agency from what people do as individuals, but to really start thinking, how are we inducing all of this?
The guy who's on the boardwalk later.
You were listening to a conversation recorded for Flashpoint on Pacifica Radio. That was Yasmin Nair and Matilda Bernstein Sycamore talking about the Orlando shooting and some implications about queer radicalism in there. We're going to hear a little music, and then we're going to come back with Matilda. We're going to talk with her live here on Preference Radio. I'm Alan. We're going to talk homonationalism and the U.S. military. Thank you. We're here on Preference. Thanks for joining us. Matilda, are you on the line?
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Oh, definitely. Thank you.
We have had the pleasure of listening to you. And Yasmin, now you're chatting for Pacifica Radio.
Yeah, I love that show. That was great.
That was great to listen to. Why don't you give our fabulous listeners a little bit of information about who you are?
Oh, who am I? Yeah. Well, I am a writer, author, and activist. My most recent book is called The End of San Francisco. I've also edited a number of anthologies. The most recent one is called Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots? Flaming Challenges to Masculinity, Objectification, and the Desire to Conform. And feel free to say anything else you'd like.
I think that's a good start. I've been following your writing and the sort of the train of your thinking for quite some time. Been pretty intrigued. I'm excited to have an opportunity to chat with you live.
Yes, I'm excited as well.
And you're calling us from Seattle, is that right?
That's right. I live in Seattle now.
Fabulous. Do you want to give us maybe a brief primer on what is happening in Seattle that catches your eye?
What is happening in Seattle? Well, right now, the tech industry and Amazon.com are taking over the city, and there's an extreme level of gentrification and displacement going on that is cheerleaded by the powers that be, as is happening in most cities where these types of things are happening. So that's the main backdrop, I would say, for Seattle right now. It's sort of a technology dystopia.
I remember, I think it was last year, perhaps the year before, that the Seattle police rolled out a Safe Spaces campaign where folks who felt unsafe on the street, queer folks, trans folks, could head into businesses, and those businesses were identified as places that were allied with the police to provide, I suppose, some sort of fairly immediate security.
Exactly. It's called Safe Place, and they have a rainbow police badge as their emblem, and businesses can display this rainbow police badge in their windows to show that allegedly, well, actually what they will do is call the cops if you come in and say you've been attacked for being queer. And obviously, as anyone who's thinking about the cops right now knows, you know, the police in Seattle, as in every city that I know of in the United States, have a long history of racist, anti-queer, anti-trans violence that goes back decades. I mean, their central goal, I would say, is to enforce that, you know, sort of systemic racism. You know, they are the power tools of displacement. And so the idea that queers calling the cops will make us safer is misguided at best. And I think in Seattle right now, actually, you know, on Capitol Hill, which is historically the gay neighborhood, where those signs are the most prevalent, there has been an upsurge in anti-queer violence, and each episode becomes more brutal, it seems. And the most recent, actually there's several, but I mean, one that got a little more publicity than others was someone who was literally leaving a benefit for, you know, the people who were murdered at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. And someone said, "Happy Pride," and then, you know, yelled anti-trans insults, and then knocked that person unconscious to the ground. And this is happening in the area where this Safe Place, literally actually two blocks from the police station, and, you know, in the area where that idea that the Safe Place signs are going to keep people safer is most prevalent. So it doesn't even serve the people it's supposed to help. So, you know, it's just another example of how hypocritical, you know, the sort of gay powers that be are. I mean, here in Seattle, we have a gay mayor who his central thing that he's doing right now is trying to get rid of one of the few places where homeless people can live in relative, you know, certainly not safety, because they're homeless on the streets because they can't afford to live in a city where, you know, housing costs are going through the roof. But his central thing right now is about criminalizing the most vulnerable people in Seattle. And so, you know, it really fits into that type of agenda.
Is there any pushback among activists against Safe Place and the sorts of relationships between the police and the community that can spring up?
I think there are small examples, but on a larger structural level, no. I mean, there is a great flyer that I saw, you know, sort of critiquing that connection, and there are certainly people who are aware of that hypocrisy. But I would say on an overall level, most people don't even really think about it.
What would you like to see happen?
What would I like to see happen in that particular instance or in general?
Both. Starting with...
certainly we need to get rid of the cops. I mean, we need to get rid of the cops, and we need to get rid of the military, and we need to fundamentally shift resources in a direction that actually supports people in self-determination. Mm-hmm. And I think anything less than that is really not doing much for us.
So what caught my eye in particular and led me to invite you to join us here on Preference? By the way, I want to take a moment and thank David, who's in the booth keeping us on the air. Thank you, David. What caught my eye was a response you had to the last week to the U.S. Navy's decision to name a ship after Harvey Milk.
Yes. Would you like to hear more?
I would.
Sure. Well, which response in particular? But I could give you a response right now.
Yeah, please do.
Well, I mean, you know, again, this is part of that sort of hypocritical assimilationist agenda. So Harvey Milk, when he was alive, you know, he marched against Vietnam. He was fired from his job for protesting the U.S. invasion of Cambodia. He was anti-violence, anti-religion, and anti-war. He was part of the counterculture, you know, of the 1970s. He was in the U.S. Navy and served in Korea, and that experience politicized him against war. You know, he became a hippie. He joined the sort of sex, drugs, and incendiary politics counterculture of that era. And so the idea of naming a warship after him, allegedly to honor his legacy, is horrifying. And I think, you know, his nephew, actually, Stuart Milk, is the one that has spearheaded that campaign for a number of years. And he argues, borrowing from the rhetoric of Harvey Milk, you know, one of his famous quotes was, "You got to give them a hope," right? And he was very much about hope. I'm not sure I agree with that rhetoric now, but at the time, it made a lot of sense. And Stuart Milk, you know, and I think a lot of, you know, mainstream gay organizations and gay power brokers are arguing that Harvey Milk's name on a warship will give people hope. So we have to back away for a second and remember that the U.S. military is, if there's any institution in the world that is the most responsible for violence, that is the U.S. military. You know, the U.S. military, the U.S. is bombing Afghanistan, Syria, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Iraq, who knows how many countries around the world that we don't even know about. And the idea that having a gay icon's name on a warship, you know, will make people more hopeful is just horrifying. And I think it really fits into, in this sense, I think the U.S. military is actually, you know, borrowing a strategy from one of its staunchest allies, which is the State of Israel. And Israel, for a long time, has used gay people as pawns you know, to argue that Israel, you know, is a beacon of hope, you know, in the Middle East where gay people can openly express themselves while enforcing the apartheid state, you know, and, you know, obliterating Gaza, you know, killing Palestinians at will. And, you know, and it's sort of that mirage allows the violence to continue. And I think this is exactly the same thing. It's, you know, you, what are they going to write? You got to give them hope on the warship as they're, you know, bombing bombs away, you know, right next to it. And I think it really does a disservice, not just to, you know, the historical legacy of Harvey Milk, but also to, you know, our present day moment where we're imagining that, you know, that our heroes must be pro-military, right? I mean, that's the sort of turn in gay culture right now. Gay culture is intertwined with militarism, imperialism, you know, patriotism, and, you know, this sort of idea of, you know, serving our country in the most brutal and oppressive ways possible. And we really need to back away from that, you know, and rethink, you know, what our priorities are.
It's great that you make a reference to pinkwashing. It's actually one of our, one of the subjects we come back to time and again here on Preference. We've had both Dean Spade and Pauline Park on different episodes of the show to talk about pinkwashing. And Kepu, just last month, aired the Seattle documentary Pinkwashing Exposed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something we're committed to keeping an eye on. So let's unpack a little bit what you think that the military is trying to tell us in naming a ship after Harvey Milk.
Well, I think the military, you know, has a long history of using oppressed people as pawns for imperialism, right? Cannon fodder. And gay people and trans people are the latest, you know, the latest cannon fodder to be included in the mix. Right? So they're saying that, you know, you can put a rainbow flag on a bomb and it's no longer a bomb. You know, gay or trans soldiers, you know, serving at a drone base in Nevada and pressing a button to, you know, take a Somali village off the map is not progress. But that's what they're telling us. They're telling us that that's progress. And I think gay power brokers swallow the whole thing. They're more than happy to, you know, to serve, you know, this sort of violent, hypocritical agenda over and over and over again, and it's tragic.
Why is that? Why are these power brokers so eager?
Well, I think the so if we go back to Harvey Milk's time, you know, the 1970s, and talk about, you know, gay liberation, the central goals, you know, of gay liberation, you know, as it was framed then, right, were not about, you know, becoming part of state violence, right? They were about eliminating state violence, right? So an end to the nuclear family, an end to organized religion, an end to U.S. militarism, an end to imperialism. It was intertwined with, you know, all of the other movements that were happening at the time. It was a radical movement to transform people's lives, you know, both in terms of personal, intimate choices, you know, rejecting sexual prudishness, rejecting, you know, enforced monogamy, you know, rejecting, you know, all of the central institutions of straight privilege. And I think now, the central goals, and, you know, for the last several decades, the central goals of so-called LGBT organizations center around accessing straight privilege, not challenging it, right? And so that's how we see marriage, for example, in the pinnacle of straight hypocrisy becoming the central goal of gay struggle. And I think in the military, actually access to the military predates marriage, you know, by a few years as the central goal. So instead of talking about ending dominant systems of oppression. It's about becoming part of those systems of oppression. And of course, that serves the people with the most power and privilege and access to resources, but it doesn't serve anyone else.
Indeed. We're talking with Matilda Bernstein Sycamore here on Preference Radio, here on KBOO. So, Matilda, the military has just recently they allowed, I think, women into all combat roles. Is being rolled out, and now they've just announced that trans folks are welcome to serve in the different branches of the military. What do you make of this?
Well, the military needs bodies, right? The military can't only rely on machines. Someone needs to press the buttons. And so the military is searching, you know, for as many people as possible. I mean, in these endless wars, I mean, there's no evidence, obviously. We have two militaristic, you know, main candidates for president. There's no difference in their foreign policy, as far as I can tell, you know, in terms of who is going to bomb more countries. I mean, I would say probably Hillary Clinton is worse on that particular issue. And I think, so the military knows that war is going to be continuing. There's nothing that's going to be stopping it. And so they need more bodies to fill those roles. And so they also, you know, they want to frame themselves as an institution that actually is about civil rights, as opposed to an institution that is about ending people's lives. And I think in that sense, they're very successful. You know, it actually, I mean, the military has trillions of dollars. I mean, they know what they're doing. And they have plenty of infrastructure invested in public relations, right? And so they can say, oh, we're welcoming, you know, transgender people to openly serve, you know, support us. And then they get all these gay institutions to say this is an amazing step for civil rights. And I think, I don't know, it's just the same things repeat themselves over and over again, and it's as if people never learn anything. I mean, you know, the structures of power, and I think in this particular case, in terms of gay assimilation in particular, and now, I mean, so fast, trans assimilation, I mean, who would even imagine, right? And like an issue that was just off the map. I mean, there was no one was calling for trans people to be openly able to serve in the U.S. military. That issue was put on the map by Jennifer Pritzker, who is a member of, you know, the Pritzker family of Chicago, whose fortune is built on real estate speculation and insider trading. And it was she who, and she is, you know, considered, you know, by some the first trans billionaire, right? And she donated $1.35 million to the Palm Center, a think tank, and that was just 3 years ago. And immediately, suddenly, this issue that no one was even thinking about it, suddenly had national headlines. And so it's the same thing, where it's the people with the most privilege who are dictating the terms for everyone else. And I think also, I think straight media has always been clueless about gay lives and is even more clueless about trans lives. And I think straight people are desperate in the center and on the left are desperate to seem open-minded, right? They are totally dripping in homophobia and transphobia and have never covered queer and trans lives. So they see something in their, you know, press release inbox, oh, trans military service? Well, I want to do something about trans people. You know, this sounds acceptable enough. Let me just throw this on the table. And they don't even think about it. Let's say anti-military, you know, leftist radio hosts, or, you know, who will suddenly have someone talking about how, you know, trans people being able to join the military is progress, right? Suddenly that's progress. And they don't even think, oh, wait, I'm against the military. Or marriage. You have these straight radio hosts who have never been married. You know, these are like people who like are veterans of the 1960s. You know, they know that marriage is, you know, backward, oppressive, and tacky. And suddenly they're like, oh, let's have gay people talk about marriage. I love marriage. This marriage is great. It's like, oh, well, that's strange. You've never been married and you're like 67, you know. Maybe there's a reason you chose not to be married, you know. And so I think there's so much hypocrisy on so many levels. And I think this whole issue really furthers structural homophobia and structural transphobia rather than challenging it.
Can you explain a little bit more about that thought, about how it extends homophobia and transphobia?
Absolutely. I think if I want to talk specifically about this, you know, this ending of the ban of, you know, trans people being able to openly serve in the U.S. military, right? So, for example, just one example, you know, there's going to be a one-year period, you know, when each branch of the U.S. military, you know, gets to implement, you know, decides how to implement these terms, right? And we can only imagine what is going to happen in that one year, right? We're going to have the same horrifying conversations that are happening nationwide right now with the idea of who is allowed into which bathroom, right? So we're going to be like, who can wear which, you know, military battlefront fatigues, you know, how are we going to rearrange the barracks, you know, so is there going to be a third one, you know, for trans people, or do trans people, you know, just all the horrifying mythologies about trans people's bodies and lives are going to play out on this national stage, and it's just, you know, it's horrifying. And I think if we look at gays in the military, you know, which emerged as a national issue around 1992, 1993 with the March on Washington, the March on Washington, I believe, was called for Lesbian, Gay, and Bisexual Rights, which was the largest gay march, you know, I believe it might still be in history. That was a moment when, you know, it was the height of the AIDS crisis in the U.S., and so many queer people, including those with power and privilege, had lost, you know, dozens of friends, right? And so universal health care was an issue that was almost a mainstream gay agenda. It was almost there. It was just about to be there. But instead of that becoming the issue for the March on Washington, for example, the big issue that year became ending the ban on gay people being able to openly serve in the U.S. military. And the whole gays in the military thing was all about proving specifically that gay men, you know, are not effeminate, you know, are not the swishing sissies, you know, walking down the aisle. They're not dying of AIDS. You know, they are willing, you know, to openly serve their country in obliterating the world just like any other man, dude. You know, it's, and that sort of hyper masculine patriotism has destroyed any hope of gay culture of having any potential for challenge or sustenance or meaning, and it has not abated in the intervening decades. And nothing could be more homophobic than that particular messaging, you know, that your life, you know, as a faggot only has meaning if you can go abroad and kill people. And that is the message. And that is the message of dominant gay culture, period.
So how do we push back?
How do we push back? Well, we need to get back to talking about, you know, the original goals of gay, trans, and queer liberation, right? So we need to get back to talking about an end to police state control of queer and trans bodies and lives. We need to be talking about gender, sexual, social, and political liberation. And we need to be talking about it not just for queers, not just along this narrow identity politic, but about talking about it for everyone. I mean, queer as an idea is about ending this sort of artificial borders of hierarchy and hypocrisy. And that was also what gay liberation was about at the beginning. And I think we need to be talking about challenging the systemic oppression of the U.S. military and our complicity in that agenda. You know, I mean, even on a very basic reformist level, I mean, we've lost just even the basic reformist idea of, say, let's just say, cutting the U.S. military budget by half, cutting it in half. If we cut the U.S. military budget in half, we would have the money to fund everything in this country that we need: housing, healthcare, you know, for everyone. You know, a guaranteed minimum income, those things would become nothing. It would just be like a snap. Oh, great, snap. You know, the military, what is it, 40% of the whole budget? I don't know the exact statistic, but it's trillions of dollars. And that money is siphoning resources away from everything that matters, whether it's, you know, relatively small things in the larger sense, you know, like, I mean, they're huge in individual people's lives, but in terms of the trillions of dollars, you know, they're nothing. You know, like, I don't know, guaranteed safe houses for queers to escape abusive homes, or, you know, cooperative housing, permanent cooperative housing for everyone who doesn't have housing right now. These things would just, boom, no problem. I mean, in terms of the financial part of it. And so I think, but that's just off the map. I mean, that is nowhere in any politician's agenda. And I think, and that's just, to me, that's basic reformism. That is not a radical agenda, to cut the U.S. military budget in half. A radical agenda is to get rid of the U.S. military. So I don't know. I mean, so I think we need to get back to talking about what actually matters.
Agree. In terms of, I think the the biggest bang for the least amount of dollars, I always think of needle exchanges, which can save people's lives.
Absolutely.
And needles come cheap. And I
absolutely
think, yeah. Well, we're nearly at the end of the show. Do you have some last thoughts? Do you have something in the works that we might want to know about and keep an eye out for?
Sure. Well, I have a new novel. It's called Sketch to See. I don't have a publisher yet, though, although I have received three rejections in a row from editors who love the book and want to publish it. So I'm kind of skeptical. What power do editors have now? It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's a little bit surprising, but hopefully it'll be out sometime in the relatively near future, although I have no idea when. Here in Seattle, I'm starting a monthly reading series in October. It's called Contagious Exchanges, Queer Writers in Conversation. So that should be fun. And other than that, I mean, who knows? Anything could happen.
Wonderful. Matilda, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Take care.
You too.
Dear listeners, Matilda's fabulous and you're fabulous as well. We'd love to see you this Saturday in Inner Northeast Portland for KBOO's book and record sale. This is one of our great fundraisers. We'd love to have you come down. You might find Coltrane vinyl you've been searching for. You might find a book by Susan Brownmiller that you didn't know you were searching for. It's on Coot Street. Go to kboo.fm and get all the details. You can also head to that website, our website, and find our archived shows, past preference shows, and upcoming schedules. We will be back on the 5th Tuesday, so 3 weeks from now, with couple of great guests. I'm pretty excited about that show. Hard Knock Radio is up next. This has been Preference.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rock the Block Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event, Saturday, August 13th at the Matt Dishman Community Center in Portland. Activities include crafts, a rock climbing wall, inflatables, a dance party, and resource table from local agencies and businesses. Again, that's the Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event, Saturday, August 13th at the Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 Northeast Knott Street in